Are you enjoying this podcast? Well, you have KUOW members to thank for that. KUOW members make the trusted local journalism and storytelling you hear on this show possible. Become a member today and help support the production of this podcast. It only takes a minute. Make a donation at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. Hi, I'm Bill Radke. Room to grow. Seattle has updated its plan to get denser. How big a change is it? Who's going to like it or not? We will discuss in a few minutes. By we, I mean me and my panel. Publicola co-founder and editor, Erica Barnett. Welcome back.
It's great to be here.
Good to see you. Washington Policy Center's Vice President Paul Guppy. Welcome back, Paul.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Former Washington State legislator, founder now of a Seattle-based climate startup, Earth Finance, Reuven Carlisle. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Good to see you. And you can see us because we are streaming the show on YouTube. You just search KUOW Public Radio. Okay, this week's headline, Washington's Democratic Majority Legislature passed three Republican-backed voter initiatives. How did that happen? Well, these were petitions that got enough voter signatures. So lawmakers either had to put them on the statewide ballot this fall or just make them law. More on that decision in a moment. First, let's tell listeners about these three new GOP-approved laws that take effect this summer. One of them rolls back restrictions on police pursuits. Police can once again chase a car if they have only a reasonable suspicion that any crime has been committed, not just a violent crime, and that the suspect poses some kind of safety threat. All of that worries Leslie Cushman with the Washington Coalition for Police Accountability. She says chases pose a big risk.
Carnage, really, and innocent people being killed. That includes alleged criminals who maybe have shoplifted. They don't deserve to die in a car wreck.
But over at State Sheriffs and Police Chiefs Association, Steve Strand says this law change tells people they cannot, for example, steal a car and just drive away. And he says police can handle this.
It's not going to be the Dukes of Hazzard out there.
Erica, you are not conjuring the Duke boys or Sheriff Roscoe, but I take it you think that this law change is dangerous.
Well, of course it does. I mean, it allows police, as you said, to go barreling after people for any reason. I think the example given by Steve Strand is instructive. Stolen cars are a thing that we are very, very good at dealing with, as a society and as a state, and actually as a city in Seattle, compared to the national average, which is around, I think, 46%. Our police recover 86% of stolen cars, and in Seattle, we don't have this law. We have a stricter law that actually places more restrictions on when police can go after people.
They have to have probable cause, or it's a violent crime?
A violent or sex-related crime. Now, I think that there is some cause for worry among safety advocates that the police in Seattle are going to consider rolling that back. Police Chief Adrian Diaz was saying last night at a Downtown Seattle Association event that, you know, that they were going to take a look at the restrictions in light of this new law. And, you know, I think that the statistics are very clear that when you make it easier for police to, you know, essentially break the law in the pursuit of, you know, solving crimes, it kills not just potential criminals, but also police and bystanders in huge numbers. And so I think there's cause for concern because this has created, in the past, has led to a lot of deaths and a lot of injuries unnecessarily.
So what I think is interesting about these initiatives is that they are initiatives from the people, that this is part of our popular democracy process. The police pursuit initiative got more than 100,000 signatures than it needed. All the initiatives added together were signed by 1.2 million signatures total. Some of that, of course, is people signing all the initiatives, but it just shows that that's where this idea came from. On the police pursuit, I see this empirically as a researcher, that the legislature passed a law in 2021, just about 2 or 3 years ago, that took away the ability of the police to pursue based on reasonable suspicion. And I think we're just finding our experiences that that didn't work. That
the State Patrol said it recorded more than 3,100 cases of drivers not stopping for police.
Exactly. And then there's the case of the person who called 911 and said, the police are chasing me. They're not allowed to chase me. They have to stop. So it creates a cultural signal among criminals that every car is a four-wheel safe house. Commit a crime, get in an automobile, and you'll be able to get away. The reasonable suspicion standard is not zero. I'm a very strong civil libertarian, so I do not think the police should be able to just chase you, pull you over, stop you for any reason. But if there's an indication that a crime has been committed, I think the public expects the police to be able to do something about it.
You know, it's interesting because you raised the first question is why did the legislature pass these? And these three are relatively more innocuous than the larger initiatives that didn't pass that are going to go directly to the voters for the simple reason that they involve billions of dollars in terms of the budgets. But in terms of the police pursuit, you know, I do think that there's a real tension between direct democracy of initiatives and representative democracy in the legislature in our system. I just don't think that governing a topic like this is a category for direct democracy. It's clunky. It's cumbersome. I think the nuance, learning from the experts, studying the data, understanding the implications. The reason the legislature adopted this particular one is clearly so that they'd have the ability to potentially modify it without a supermajority vote. And that just allows for a richer, deeper policy analysis and discussion.
Well, do you have a position on the police pursuit change?
You know, I do. I mean, I was sort of in the middle on this one. And I will say that when I was in the state Senate, I was one of the very few Democrats that did vote to allow authorization for police, not quite to the extent that the initiative language has. There was a more scaled back version. But I do think that governing local police departments and professionals in this category is very tough from a governance point of view. And Senator John Lovick is a former Washington State Patrolman. He's a state senator. He's an African-American. And he was a strong leader in the legislature in saying, look, we don't want to have a governance structure that overly restricts a police in terms of their pursuit policy. So I followed him on that vote and really respected the institutional knowledge that he brought to this category.
I think that you have to illustrate a problem, and I think 3,100, I'm not sure where that statistic is from, but 3,100...
State Patrol said it recorded that.
...vehicles not stopping. What does that mean in terms of criminal activity, in terms of violent criminal activity in particular? Because, again, this law says if there's a reasonable suspicion that you have violated a law, and so that is any law. So it literally is, you know, as the advocate suggested, you know, if you think somebody has shoplifted a thing, you can go and drive after them, you know, at 75, 80, 100 miles an hour. And I don't think that those two things are balanced. I think the danger of doing that, as we've seen, I mean, we had, you know, it wasn't a pursuit situation, but in Seattle, we are still reckoning with the fact that a police officer killed a woman because she was collateral damage as he was speeding down a 25-mile-an-hour street. This is not a safe thing to be doing, and so it should only be done in extreme circumstances.
Is there a line? Where would you draw the line? Do you want no police or high-speed pursuits? And or if some of them are okay, where would you draw that line?
I mean, I would probably draw the line somewhere around where the police department now draws it, which is having probable cause, I believe, is our standard of a violent or sex offense related crime. I don't think that people should be pursued at high speed for especially stolen vehicles because they are very easy to recover. And so that is something we are good at. That is something that like we already know we can do.
Okay.
Or shoplifting, things like that. It just seems completely out of balance.
Paul, last word on this before we move on. So, anything more to say?
Sure. Just again, I just think of this in practical terms that I don't think Washington State should become the car theft capital of the world. If people understand that you can steal a car here and get away with it, then we're going to have a lot more of that.
Well, we've been the car theft capital of the world for 30 years. I mean, that is just a fact.
So that's not a good thing.
Are quite high in Washington and have been before this law. Were after this law will continue to be. Those are for reasons independent, I think, of whether criminals, quote unquote, are coming to Washington State and deciding to steal cars.
Let Paul finish and then we'll.
Sure. And then I guess my bottom line point is I don't want to create a culture in which it's encouraging people to run away from the police. The reason that there are 80-mile-per-hour chases is because people do not stop and cooperate with the police and answer their questions or solve the issue that way. Okay. So the problem is people who are fleeing from the police create the dangerous situation.
All right. Well, we've laid out some of the pros and cons in that response to that situation. We've, as we said, two other Republican-backed initiatives going into effect this summer. Another prohibits the state income tax that's already illegal, and it forbids local governments to impose income taxes. And voters like it that way. They've said so over and over. And the third Republican-backed initiative that takes effect this summer is the so-called Parents' Bill of Rights, that would allow parents to examine instruction materials, obtain student records, opt out their kids out of classroom activities. Does anyone know what this allows parents to do that they can't already do?
That was exactly part of the debate on the both in committee and on the House floor regarding this. And that's why I think it passed by such a wide bipartisan margin, is that, you know, one school of thought is it's not really going to have. Well, it's technically true. It won't repeal or change any existing law or regulation that's in place. And I think that was the assurance for a lot of the Democrat members to vote for it. But I think the underlying, going back to the point about direct democracy, and I'll pick up on Reuven's point about legislating through initiative, which is complex. It's not so much the details of the policy. I think it's the message that the public is trying to send, that there is tension between a lot of parents and their local school district, and they just want that to be resolved. I think parents want to be treated as trusted partners and not as some kind of suspicion. And that's the source of how this idea got rolling in the first place.
You know, at the same time, where it really got rolling, of course, is a guy named Brian Haywood, who was instrumental in funding the initiatives. They did line up the six initiatives, and they paid $3 per signature. You know, that's a dynamic that exists in our state that
we
all know
about. That's
the system. That's the system, exactly. So it is the system, but I wouldn't say that it's this groundswell of deep passion as much as identifying a couple of categories. So parents and access to educational materials, some issues with medical services and trans issues, and that sort of touched on some of those sentiments that parents. Then you've got the issue around income taxes. Then you've got the issue around climate. And so all of these issues were touching sort of the hot buttons, and it was an opportunity for Brian Haywood to step into a role of political leadership. He's talking about running for office. He's, you know, super invested in sort of making a big splash, and he's had some good counsel about how to do that effectively as a Republican in this state. So that's direct democracy. I'm not opposed to it, but I think we should just sort of be transparent about how that works and what's going on.
Anything more to say about this?
I just want to make it clear. It does change things. It's not just entirely codifying things that are already codified. It allows parents, for example, to look into their kids' mental health records, which are by law ordinarily confidential. And so it gets rid of that confidentiality in the school setting. And this is where the issues with outing trans kids comes up. But it's also, you know, have you sought counseling for depression? Have you sought counseling because you're gay and don't feel like it's safe for you to come out at home? Have you sought reproductive health care? I mean, a lot of stuff that is private will no longer be private for kids. And I think that the concern is that, you know, they will be at risk of, you know, their parents being told. And not all parents, as much as we would like to believe they are wonderful and provide great safe environments for children, especially kids who are, you know, not sort of, you know, who are outcast in some way, who are trans, who are LGBTQ+. I mean, it's just, you know, it has a potential Pandora's box quality to it that I think, you know, should be acknowledged.
Okay, well, let's talk about the three voter initiatives that got enough signatures, but the legislature did not approve them. These will go onto your November ballot. And as you suggested, Reuven, those are bigger deals. I think we all agreed on that. Repeal the capital gains tax, eliminate the state's carbon cap and trade, cap and invest system. I'm sitting next to the author of that, right, Reuven Carlisle?
That's right.
And letting workers opt out of a payroll tax that pays for the state's long-term care insurance program. What should listeners know about what's coming? It's going to be quite a November ballot in the state.
You know, there's a fiscal note to the cap and invest bill. I mean, I would say that the Environmental Defense Fund and the Rocky Mountain Institute, the two premier climate think tanks in the world have both called the Climate Commitment Act the gold standard for state climate policy. So it's a cap on emissions that declines between now and 2050 that gets us in compliance with the letter and the spirit of the Paris Agreement. That's what it is. And the implications of it are that there's about 100 large-scale emitters, polluters, and they have to pay for their emissions, and those dollars are reinvested into decarbonization. And the major use of the money is electric ferries, hybrid ferries, so new ferries. The number two category, the largest category of all, actually, is culverts. So salmon restoration statewide is about a $4 or $5 billion bill.
Helping fish get under highways.
Exactly. And that's a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that we have to do that. So it's a mandate, sort of like that McCleary lawsuit for the state, but on the transportation budget.
And it's incredibly expensive.
And that's all from Climate Commitment Act money. And then free transit for youth and lots of transit support statewide. So this sort of the old-fashioned rhetorical idea that this pays for bike paths in Seattle or something is just not true. It's a statewide network. It pays for enabling all of our transportation infrastructure. So profound $10-plus billion implications the next 10 years or so if it were repealed. So it's strong climate policy that's been globally recognized. We're talking about connecting with California and Quebec's system of reducing emissions further. So a lot of impact, certainly on the climate legislation as well as the others.
And we're not going to debate out these three. This is going to be the topic for the next, what is it, 6 months? Or we'll constantly be talking about these. But maybe each of you could, if you have one thing to say, what's something listeners should know today about these coming ballot initiatives or the fact that the legislature decided which ones to
If we have one thing to say, I'm not sure you know who you're talking to here.
I did my best. Done my best.
But we'll be quick. My main point is really about listening to what the public has to say and notwithstanding the initiative process. Again, as an analyst, I think to myself, where did these issues come from? And one of the most common comments we hear is frustration that, you know, the state leaders, are not listening to us. And I just think there's been they haven't managed these issues in a way that would have avoided any traction, regardless of who's organizing the initiative. The fact that people did sign them, I think, is a signal to the leaders, not so much on the details, but just that the rising cost of gasoline or energy, the police pursuit issue that we already talked about, or parental rights, and now these other taxes. You look at those across the board, and to me, those are signals that the public is concerned about these issues and want them to be dealt with in some way. And the thing I'll say about the cap and invest law is the state has, you're going to hear a lot about cuts and how this is going to cost the state money, and that's just not true. The state has plenty of money. The budget has doubled in about the last 10 years, and all of this revenue is prospective. It will not affect any program that's in existence today, and in fact, revenue is expected to go up. So I don't think it's about money. I think it's more about what kind of policies we have.
I'd like to cede my time to Ruben because I see him smiling over there.
We have to have a whole tackle on that. The Climate Commitment Act enabled the comprehensive grand bargain that enabled a $17 billion transportation package. It's $5, $6, $7 billion of that package. You cannot take out that chunk of money and then not have profound implications on every road, every bridge, every highway, every transit, every aspect. So the budget will have to be redrawn from scratch if you take out $5 to $7 billion.
Okay. But the electorate can say that's not money we want you to have, and you know this is how the system works. I noticed that Dave Reichert, who's running for governor, used the word dictatorship, referring to Jay Inslee last week. Maybe not that he's a dictator, but I think he was talking. I don't remember what specific issue he was talking, but it's come up a lot that he's a tyrant, he's a dictator. Is that how Mussolini did it? Like the voters can sign a petition, and the party in power has to either enact them, now it's law, or put them to a vote of the people. At the Washington Policy Center?
Yeah.
Does this weaken the Republicans' argument that the Democrats are running roughshod?
Well, that's a good point. Well, first of all, for the record, I'm pretty sure that Mussolini didn't have an initiative process.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
So, but in practical terms, yes, if you know, if the Democrats who govern the state respond to these issues and manage them, then and actually signal, yes, we see that people are frustrated. People sign these petitions. I'm not really too concerned about state budget writers handling $5 to $7 billion. I'll leave that up to them. What that does is what Reichert is looking for, obviously, as a challenger, is traction on some issue that will get people's attention.
Yes.
Okay. And that's what he's trying to do.
Just real quick, on the initiative process in Washington State, I mean, I think it is faux naive to suggest that people are signing initiatives knowing fully what the implications would be when an initiative, when a signature gatherer comes up to them at, you know, I guess not the Safeway anymore, but at the Trader Joe's and says, well, you sign this, it's for less taxes. And so I think that there is a real question to be had about why do we have a government if the people, you know, should just be writing all the laws themselves anyway, based on what billionaires, you know, put on the ballot and put ads out on the radio and TV for. I mean, we don't make these decisions about particularly, you know, signature, putting our signatures on things, but voting either in a vacuum. And I think we can't pretend that, you know, what we should really do is do away with government and just let the citizens decide everything, because we do elect people for a reason.
Okay, there's the huge democracy versus republic debate rearing up its head. Before we take a break, is there anything more to say about what the legislature did or didn't that you think is most important of all that listeners ought to know?
Well, I'll throw in something as someone who follows the legislature regularly every single session, is there was a remarkable lack of controversy and debate regarding the budget. They had to adjust the budget halfway through the two-year cycle. As Reuven knows, that just happened routinely this year, and then they adjourned on time. So to me, what was interesting is, you know, we're going back and forth about what issues they were controversial and they had to deal with, and yet underneath that, they made several billion-dollar adjustment in the budget, and it flew right through, right on time.
Okay. Almost like something to smile about. It's like it was
exactly
the end of the show.
Something
okay.
Effective.
Otherwise, I know you wanted to mention ferries, and you sort of briefly did, Reuven. Mm. You thought that was a big deal?
Yeah.
Electric ferries.
They put about $700 million into finishing the 520 bridge.
Oh, and yeah.
That's delayed by years and decades and chaos of community construction issues, and so to actually try to take care of those cost overruns, that's sort of a big deal. And there's a lot of money that went into behavioral health and schools. I mean, you know, stuff that the underbelly of government that you don't really see as much, but really important investments.
Erica, you noted what the legislature did not do, which was to raise the cap on property taxes.
They did not. So we have a 1% cap on property taxes going up every year. Without getting into too many details, the effective property tax rate in Washington State is below 1%. And, you know, nationwide, we have a very low property tax rate. I know it doesn't feel like that when you pay your property taxes because housing prices are going up and your house value is going up. But the fact that we have this cap means that counties cannot, you know, raise their budgets in a way that is commensurate with inflation, for example, or the cost of doing business, which is not directly always related to inflation, construction costs and things like that. So the longer the cap goes on, the further counties fall behind. And this would have allowed them to raise it to 3% a year, and that did not happen.
Yeah. Shout out to another voter initiative, if I remember correctly.
Well, that's the origin of it from 2001,
yeah.
But then it was ratified under Gary Locke in a bipartisan bill. That's the current law we have now.
Yeah. Okay, we're talking laws. We're going to talk about growth. How can we not talk about growth? The Seattle updated its plan to allow for more density. What should you know about that? We're going to come right back.
This podcast is free, and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks!
You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review. You might be watching it on YouTube. You just search KUOW Public Radio. In any case, you'll see or hear former state legislator Reuven Carlisle on the panel today, Washington Policy Center's Paul Guppy, and Publicola's Erica Barnett. Oh, I'm Bill Radke. How will Seattle make room for at least 100,000 newcomers, and is that the right amount? This week, the mayor updated the growth plan, which is how the city decides where to allow more homes, where to allow taller buildings. Right now, most Seattle lots can have three homes, a main house with a so-called mother-in-law apartment and a little backyard cottage. The new rules allow at least four homes, six if they're affordable or you're close to transit. And the city would create 24 new neighborhood centers near transit and commercial areas where you could have six-story apartments, for example, around the business strips in Maple Leaf or Magnolia. Now, will this motivate developers to build enough homes? Seattle architect Matt Hutchins says nope.
We're adding a little bit, a little increment of housing to existing neighborhoods, but we're not really embracing the challenge that we face.
That challenge being the housing shortage. On the other hand, developer Rocky De Herrera says he looks forward to building more homes under this plan.
This is good work on the part of the city of Seattle.
Erica, you've reported on this directly. What's your take on how much the city is now allowing itself to grow and where?
Well, I think there's two facets to that. One is how much is it allowing in terms of housing capacity? And the answer is not very much. This would have the effect of allowing 100,000 new units, essentially.
The city says at least. I don't know how that works. They say it's a floor. It's
there's
at least.
There's no way to know.
Yeah,
you know, so
that's about
it's,
what it sounds
so,
like.
So it's an estimate. That's 20,000 more units than the do-nothing alternative. And it's the same as the much lower, you know, alternatives 2, 3, and 4. And so I think it's just that is an important number. That is for 250,000 people projected by the city to come here. So within the next 20 years. So that is not enough unless we're going to all be in 2.5 person households, which is not very likely because the current household is about two people on average. So there's that. The other question, which I think Matt Hutchins probably also talked about in that interview, is what is actually going to be built? And I wrote a piece a while back called "Are Fourplexes Real?" And what I meant by that was, you know, is this a housing type? When you think of a fourplex, it's four units in one building, right? Is this a housing type that's going to get built? And the answer developers say is no, for, you know, all kinds of reasons, among which is, you know, the size of the units you have to build, just kind of the practicalities of building on lots. But
there's still rules about how much. How much acreage you can cover.
There's limitations. Yeah. So it has to essentially be, you know, similar to the footprint of a single family house. And that's true now with these so-called triplexes, too. So you can allow things and then you can also make them impossible with zoning rules. And I fear that that's what's happening. And these just quickly on the 24 neighborhood nodes you mentioned, a lot of those are places where a little more density is already allowed. And so it's not changing much. And they are within a ridiculously small area. 800 feet, which is, you know, a little over a block in every direction, generally speaking. And so you're talking about, they describe it as a 3-minute walk to transit, which is not a metric that exists in any other planning document I've ever seen in my life. So it is incredibly modest.
Oh, I always believe in, when I look at policy, going to the source. So what we're seeing is the result of the Growth Management Act that was put in place. So that's the root cause of the limit on buildable land. Seattle's approach and other communities around the state are required to have these plans to increase density within the growth management boundary. But there's no discussion about increasing the supply of land, expanding into new communities. And so what that does, and again, as a lifetime Seattleite, what I think about is how it changes the character of a city that we all love, open, walkable, a garden city. And by making it more, if the only solution is making it more dense, then that is going to mean a lot of tearing down existing houses and building completely new and different houses. So it will change the character of long-established neighborhoods.
You've also got a dynamic where the last couple of years, there's just this profound shift to appreciate the growth and the need for housing, the need for supply. So there's no question that people have woken up to the implications of density, the opportunities for it. At the same time, the framework was passed by the legislature last year relative to increasing density at, sort of at a pretty substantial level. But it really is up to local government to construct the design of that. They know the impact in neighborhoods. They know the impact in arterials. And I do think that the mayor's plan does a pretty good job of trying to find that balance. And I just, you know, I think the real question on some level is – is there a future in a city like Seattle and other major cities where single-family homes have a place? And a lot of folks who are, you know, super passionate about density will say categorically not. And some will say there is. I think
I've never heard anyone say that, Ruben.
I've never heard anyone say single-family homes don't have a place.
No, and I've reported on this for, you know, more than 20 years.
Totally. I'm just saying that there's a systems issue at play, which is there a tapestry of different types of housing? And this movement toward density is important, and we got to figure it out. But I think that there is value in it being done at the city level. And you have folks who, like the mayor and the team, really looking deeply at an area. And I think 100,000 homes as a baseline is a pretty good starting point. Now, do we need to get to 250 by a certain date? And how do we do that? It's a heck of a challenge.
Well, I think that, you know, how we do it in part is, you know, I mean, people talk a lot about the rights and the, you know, the sadness of the single family homeowner who might have to live next to apartments eventually. But I don't think that single family houses are going away or in danger. I think what we do is we don't think about the lives and the lifestyle and just the quality of life of the renters that are going to make up the majority of Seattle now, that will continue to do so, because houses are now, you have to make $214,000 to afford a house. So most people are going to be renters. And putting all rental housing and concentrating it on highways and arterial streets in giant buildings, which is what this plan continues to do. We used to have an urban village strategy. This plan continues that strategy and rebrands it. I think that is, you know, it just shows a sort of a priority. We have a priority in the city, and it's creating a, as you said, Paul, a garden city where the majority of us have to live on these busy highways and arterials in giant buildings, and in order to preserve the single family lifestyle of people who own houses that are now worth more than $1 million on average.
Why isn't that a good balance to have? You get your urban city living and you preserve your garden living?
Because vibrant cities elsewhere in the country have small apartment buildings scattered throughout neighborhoods, and they don't affect the character of those neighborhoods. That is an option that we have not been willing to consider in the city, because single family homeowners, you know, who make up the majority of our elected officials as well, I would point out, you know, are very, very opposed to welcoming those neighbors into their communities. They want to put them, because not everybody who rents necessarily wants to live in a giant apartment building. I mean, I think that should be obvious, but I think sometimes people don't realize that because they just don't think about that part of the population when making these kinds of decisions.
You've written a lot about, of course, Seattle's one of the highest percentages of single family homes. At the same time, the question is, do we go to the opposite extreme? Is it zero? Is it 5%? Is it 10? Like, what
is
that?
I don't think we're at risk of, I mean, I think
what
that's
is that
a
number?
Especially in Broadmoor, Windermere.
Right.
What is that number? I mean, I think that's part of the interesting question. What does a tapestry that has diverse housing look like? And I think this plan is on that pathway to trying to figure that out.
Well, it doesn't add any diversity in neighborhoods. It adds one more unit. It adds the exact, the legislation you referred to, Ruben, 1110, which passed last year. It adds the exact amount, and possibly not quite as much, according to the Seattle Times reporting, as 1110 requires. It's the bare minimum. It is the bare minimum. And then a little bit in these little neighborhood nodes that, as a kind of sweetener. But otherwise, it's the bare minimum.
So that's
wrap us up, Paul.
Sure thing. So it's interesting that one model is what you might call the Broadmoor strategy, which is build a brick wall around your neighborhood and there will be no change at all. That's obviously not desirable. But again, I'll go back to my other point, is what I look at is what new areas might be available if the growth management boundary were adjusted. Then affordable housing could be built in, and this is what other parts of the country do, is instead of you have a mix of more density in existing neighborhoods, but also opening up new areas that are much more affordable for home buyers.
But aren't, I mean, you know, I don't think that that's a very likely outcome. But I mean, it's also true that suburbs are doing better than we are in adding density already. So that is happening. And Seattle is actually now falling behind places like Bellevue, places like
Bellevue
Issaquah.
Is planning for 150,000.
Yeah.
Think.
And that is partly because suburbs like need to catch up. But they're doing it now, and we're lagging. And so now we are, you know, on the back foot compared to places like Bellevue.
And they're doing it with transit in mind.
Could Seattle, could the region or the state, or maybe it's already doing this, allow for more growth in the Bellevue, Olympia, Everett, Tacoma? Does Seattle need to take so much growth? I'll stop there.
Well, I think you're talking about a lifestyle question, too. I mean, you know, the sort of idea that people should just live in the suburbs and, you know, anybody who can't afford to live here should be consigned to the outer rings and we'll just let them live in their big apartment complexes.
Why are they outer rings? You know, I mean, Tacoma's
Because downtown Seattle, well, I'm not saying Tacoma, but downtown Seattle is a job center. The mayor talks about this all the time, and it is the job center for the region. And so when you're saying, in order to protect our single-family lifestyles in the city of Seattle, we're going to allow places outside Seattle to, you know, to have giant apartment complexes that we'll never have to look at. And then they can have their commutes in every day for an hour or an hour and a half each way, you know, of their life that's going to be lost. I mean, I think
seems so old-fashioned for Seattle to be the sun and everybody has to commute to Seattle.
Right. At the same time, down in Pierce County. Something like 65% of the folks of Tacoma and Pierce County do commute into King County. So Erica's right in that there's a really deep structural issue that touches on quality of life and transportation and every one of those issues. So we got to figure out the balance.
Okay.
So
just Paul?
Very quickly. So two trends that might be interesting in the future is one, telecommuting, which has now become standard. So maybe there'll be less problem that way. Mm-hmm. And the other one is, you know, we're assuming that population is going to continue to grow, but other states have seen their population level off or even decline. So it could be that the projections that we have in the future may not actually materialize at that level.
I think Jeff Bezos would pick Amazon and move it somewhere else, right? What does he care? He doesn't live here.
Yeah, not anymore.
Not anymore. Okay, before we take a break, Seattle's city attorney's office barred an elected judge from hearing new criminal cases. And Erica, a lot of our listeners don't even live in Seattle, but you think this is not just a Seattle procedural, but there are more important forces involved.
Well, I think so. City Attorney Ann Davison issued what's called a blanket affidavit, which basically means no criminal cases are going to be heard in Judge Pooja Vidati's courtroom from the city. And, you know, I think it is a separation of powers issue because, as you said, the judge is independently elected. And I think it is also, as I wrote when it happened, it's the nuclear option. Instead of sort of doing on a one-off basis, you know, we don't agree with this, how this judge is probably going to rule on this case. You know, so we're worried about it. So we're going to issue an affidavit. They just did a blanket one. And so
is that what the system allows them to do if they want to?
They are allowed to do that.
Well, how is it different from, I remember in King County, the public defender's department, did they do basically the same thing to a conservative judge?
It's different because in the case of the defenders, DPD, the defenders, they issued affidavits they issued a lot of affidavits, but in the city's case, the city attorney has one client, which is the city. In the case of DPD, they have individual clients and they have to decide in every single case in consultation with their client what to do. And so it is a different thing than a city that has one client saying the city is not going to have any cases in this courtroom ever again. It throws the court into chaos. It, you know, it requires them to, you know, spend a lot of money that the city doesn't really have on pro tem.
The vibe
judges.
I'm picking up is that it's Ann Davison, conservative, who doesn't like the liberal rulings of an elected judge. Is that basically what's happening?
This is, I think, you know, for me, that is a plausible explanation, but I also think that Ann Davison's office gave examples in their pretty incendiary memo about this and said, look, you know, she's ruled in this ridiculous way on, you know, DUI cases and DV cases. I want to see the examples before saying, you know, this is absolutely political or not. And the problem is they haven't released those examples.
Okay, Erica, waiting for examples. Anything else to be said?
Well, what just concerns me is when something that we all expect to be a normal, functioning part of government suddenly becomes a big controversy. So most people have never heard of this judge or could barely even name who Ann Davison is. And as Ruben knows, a lot of government works that way, and that's the way it should work. It's well-funded. It's run by professionals. And when I first saw this, I thought it was remarkable that a group of lawyers had issued basically a vote of no confidence in a particular judge. And that in itself is the problem, because what the public wants is that judicial system to operate smoothly and professionally, and it's not happening in this case.
All right. We'll see if there's more to learn there. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to pause and decide whether to cross or not when we come back, and we'll hit some headlines, and we'll find a reason to smile. Just stay tuned. This is KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Reuven Carlisle was a state representative, state senator,
both,
chaired the Environment, Energy, and Technology Committee. Now he's sitting next to me on Week in Review. This is the pinnacle of your career, I think.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's why I worked for 14 years to get to this moment.
Publicola co-founder and editor Erica Barnett is with us, and Paul Guppy, who's VP at Washington Policy Center. And we are going through some of the big events this week. We hit some of the large topics of discussion. I want to tick through some other things that we may or may not have something to say about. We were talking about the legislature earlier. Lawmakers, something they did not do is pass a bill to limit enforcement of jaywalking laws. The idea was to change it so that you just enforce jaywalking when it was 35 mile per hour plus traffic and only if somebody suddenly moved in front of a car. You know, raise the bar. Don't enforce jaywalking laws as much as we've been. And they decided not to do that. Is that good news, bad news, no news?
Well, I mean, the report that this came out after the legislative session about jaywalking suggests that, it should not be enforced the way it is. So I think not doing anything about it and leaving the laws as they are is bad news. And, you know, I know that there's sort of a picture of jaywalking that is like, you know, the person who like walks at the, you know, darts out into traffic in downtown Seattle and isn't looking where they're going or whatever. But, having lived in Southeast Seattle for a long time, before now, I often was on Rainier Avenue and, you know, people jaywalk there all the time. And the reason they jaywalk is because not jaywalking is to walk 5 or 10 minutes in one direction to finally get to a crosswalk and then walk all the way back down. And, you know, there's a lot of people who will lose an hour's pay if they're 1 minute late to work. Not to mention, you know, I can certainly understand why you wouldn't want to walk that much distance just to get to where you're going across the street. So it's in a lot of cases it's a street design issue, and that's what we should be focusing on rather than penalizing people for trying to cross the street in a logical way.
You know, at the same time, I got to take a bold, courageous stand in favor of standing at the street corner and reflecting for 30 seconds and just crossing the street.
Is it 30 seconds or 5 minutes?
Well, sometimes the lights. Okay. But I think that jaywalking is almost sort of a little bit of a symbolic representation of quality of life. I just think when you think about those big East Coast cities and Chicago and other places where there's sort of just a chaotic element, some of the cultural ethos of Seattle is unique in that there's sort of a gentleness. And I just think that being sensitive to jaywalking enforcement is spot on. And street design, spot on. Absolute drivers. But to walk away from any kind of enforcement and just say that it's really open-ended and there's just no implications to it, I think does...
Well, again, this was to limit it to 35 miles per hour plus. Yeah. And if someone was being reckless, however they define it.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it would send a deeply representative about enforcement. And again, no one's pretending like anyone should be in serious trouble for it. But I do think there's a cultural ethos. I think it's part of our civic society and engagement. And I just think it's something that people value and appreciate. And if that fundamentally shifts into sort of absolutely no questions asked in any way, like a super big city, I think we lose something.
Paul?
So in policy work, there's a saying that if you want to undermine public respect for any rule or law, you should enforce it strictly every single time. So, and that definitely applies to something like jaywalking. So I absolutely agree that, you know, Seattle is a pleasant, walkable city. It should be designed in a way so there are protected crosswalks frequently. I remember the rule when I was first learning, you know, driver's ed back in high school, which is pedestrians always have the right of way. So that's a good rule of respect and safety for pedestrians. At the same time, there are elements to this about allowing the police to do their job. There's controversy over how often they stop people, why they stop people. And I think that should be...
that they're just checking to see if that person's got a warrant.
Exactly. And so that requires oversight. Police have to operate under rules. At the same time, I guess my message would be that Seattle does need to... has had a problem, I would say, with defunding the police, depolicing over the last few years, which resulted in about 400 officers leaving the police force. force. So now the city council...
The city didn't actually defund the police, though.
Well, right? Okay. But as I understand it, the city council is now trying to recruit more police. Right. That's what I'm trying to get at. And so in order to attract applicants so we can fill these positions, you know, whether it's jaywalking or other rules, I think there should be a general message from the community that we support the police and what they do, as long as there's oversight and that they're following the rules.
Couple quick fact checks. The first police recruitment bonuses were put into effect before the pandemic, and they have been in effect for most of the time since 2019. So the city has been ardently trying to recruit police for a very long time, and for half a decade now. And police forces are diminishing across the country. It's not because Seattle said in 2020 for half a second that we might want to invest in other things. It's because of a national trend that is you know happening in every single city, no matter what they did. But to the issue of jaywalking, I mean, there are statistics that show that Black and homeless people in Seattle and in Washington State are targeted disproportionately by police for, alleged jaywalking. So if you're Reuben jaywalking across the street, you're probably not going to get targeted. If you're, if you're a homeless person, you are very likely to get targeted. And so I think that we have to look at disproportionality and say, I don't think it's just a suspicion that they're targeting, certain people more. I think that it is statistically true that certain people are getting hit with jaywalking tickets more. And of course, homeless people can't afford the tickets that, that I could afford when I got one 20 years ago. I do jaywalk. I guess I have that East Coast ethos, even though I'm not from the East Coast.
There is productive jaywalking. I just want to say, sometimes you're doing everyone a favor by going when you're not stopping anyone versus going when you're gumming up traffic.
Sometimes it's called for.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm from a jaywalking culture, and I don't apologize for it. Like I don't think Seattle has like this soft, gentle, Mayberry with high rises culture anymore, and I think that's fine. I think cities changed and we've grown.
I don't pretend to be ideologically totally pure. what's a little inconsistency among friends?
So let's hit a few more things before we start to wrap up the show. Things listeners might be interested in. Oregon reversing its drug decriminalization next door. They were the first state in the nation to decriminalize in 2020. A lot of people have overdosed since then, and some of them died, and now possession is going to be a misdemeanor. The state estimates 1,300 new misdemeanor convictions a year and more than 500 jail sentences per year for possessing a small amount of fentanyl, meth, or cocaine. Also, the chair of the National Transportation Safety Board testified this week to the Senate that Boeing has refused to provide investigators with the information they asked for about the door plug that blew off last month mid-flight.
Boeing has not provided us with the documents and information that we have requested numerous times over the past few months, specifically with respect to opening, closing, and removal of the door and the team that does that work at the Renton facility.
Boeing says it has now sent that employee list, and the company said, quote, if the door plug removal was undocumented, there would be no documentation to share. My understanding is jet repairs are not allowed to be undocumented.
Okay. But in either case, I mean, when I saw the story, the first thing I thought of is if you have a problem with an aviation product, cooperate with the authorities 100% because it's about rebuilding confidence in Boeing designs. That's really the bottom line.
Yeah. I'd like to make a segue and say Russell Wilson's going to the Jets, but we don't know that yet. We just know the Broncos cut him, even though they still have to pay him $85 million guaranteed dollars.
I hate when that happens.
Bummer, right? Okay, let's wrap up the show. We just have a couple of minutes left. I want to make time for anything that made you and maybe the listeners could smile this week.
Well, I wrote about this on my Substack last week, and it's a little Publicola exclusive, meaning it's sort of my little frivolous column. But there's this app that has been around for like 7 years that allows you to it's called Too Good To Go, and allows you to buy at a very low cost things that local restaurants and cafes are going to throw away otherwise. And, I mean, is it deep down like secretly a scam? I don't know. But it's been great using it over the last 2 weeks. There was a New York Times article about it. And I'm just
hoping. What kind of food?
Well, this is the thing. So it's mostly baked baked goods and stuff like that so far that I've been able to find. But and there are some meals, but I'm hoping that it'll expand so it's a little more like it is in other cities where there is, you know, you can get like a surprise meal. That does happen, but it's so far it's been mostly adding to my carbohydrate load.
Yeah, I hate waste. That seems like the way things ought to go.
Yeah, cut food waste. Good idea.
Yeah, yeah. Who else smiled this week?
So I hopped on a bus. I went for a bus ride, and there was literally a singing bus driver.
Wow.
And it was wonderful.
Like operatic?
Yeah, practically. It was just fabulous. He was smiling. He was just having an amazing day. And we just all sort of looked at him, and wow. It was just wonderful.
Hope he could sing well.
Yeah, he did. He did.
Good, good, good. Paul.
So this might be oversharing, but this week my wife and I have been working with a child in our home who is developmentally delayed. He doesn't speak, but he crossed a big barrier. He learned to count to three with his fingers. Mm-hmm. And what's hilarious is that he really concentrates on one and two. And when he gets to three, his face breaks out in an enormous smile that makes me think, this child's going to do very well. And in fact, my prediction is that he will be an academic mathematician someday.
Oh, excellent. Thank you, Paul. I'll just add that, you know, some people like a smoky wine. It's got something to do with the toasting of the oak barrel. But you don't want too much wildfire smoke. And at KUOW correspondent Anna King told us, researchers are developing coatings to spray on the grapes. And I'm going to play that.
Researchers sprayed the grapes early in the season. Then the coatings grow with the grapes, sort of like an expanding balloon. Before the ripe grapes are crushed for wine, the coating and the smoke flavors are rinsed off, leaving just the flavors of the Northwest wine.
Made of what, you're asking? Beta-cyclodextrin, generally recognized as safe by the FDA, and chitosan, a fibrous sugar that comes from the outer skeleton of shellfish. Will it give your Cabernet notes of shellfish? I don't think so, but maybe that's preferable to notes of wildfire smoke. That's the end of the show. Thank you so much. Erica Barnett, Publicola co-founder and editor, Washington Policy Center Vice President Paul Guppy, ex-legislator Reuven Carlisle, now runs the climate startup Earth Finance. Thank you so much for being on our panel this week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's the week gone by. Week in Review is produced by Kevin Kenistat, and it sounds good because of Bernard Willett running the board. I'm Bill Radke. See you next week.